The Loose Cannons podcast is a free-form discussion about film that contains mature language,
such as poop and titty,
and descriptions of mature situations,
such as filing taxes and raising children.
We do not have any concern for spoilers, so if you haven't seen the film or films we are discussing and don't want to have the twists ruined for you, please watch the film before listening to the podcast.
He tries to make his brother rich, he kills him. He tries to make the young lady happy, he makes her unhappy. Whatever he tries to do is wrong. Because it has to be wrong. Because the situation is such that whatever you do is wrong. All films about crime are about capitalism. Because capitalism is about crime. I mean, quote unquote, morally speaking. At least that's what I used to think. Now I'm convinced.
Hey everyone, it's another episode of Loose Cannons coming at ya. Today we're going to be discussing 1995's Red Hollywood, directed by Tom Anderson and Noel Birch. This is the voice of Ruben, of course, and joining me to accomplish that task is our core four. Say hello, Patrick.
Hello.
Basil.
There I am.
Hello.
That works.
Ilya's having some technical difficulty, so if he disappears at some point during the episode, just assume
no one will notice.
Ghost. Ghost of the internet, like the lawnmower man.
Doesn't even have the excuse of being hit by fireworks. If I'm hit by stray fireworks during the podcast, just soldier on without me.
That's right. We are recording this on the infamous Fireworks Uh-oh. Day.
Fireworks Tuesday.
Mr. Fireworks.
Nice.
Not quite.
Mr. Fireworks comes around and throws fireworks at children. Everyone knows that famous holiday. Speaking of things that are extremely dangerous, let's do a little segment we like to call Heralds and Denouncements.
Okay, I want to denounce a film. This movie is called, I believe it's Goat Door. I'm not sure how you say it. It's,
Goat Door?
It's in French, but Goat Door?
Gold Coast?
Goat, yeah.
The Buñuel film?
What? No. It's a short animated film.
Oh, wait, that's Lodge Door.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, not Lodge Door. This is Goat. It's G-O-U-T-T-E, which I believe is Goot, and I guess that's how you would say it. I don't know that word either.
Goot door, yeah.
Something about gold. Mm-hmm. But it's a...
Oh, yeah, it's the name of a neighborhood in Paris. Sorry.
Oh, okay. Sure. But this is a movie about a pirate who enters the kingdom of the dead and meets the queen of the land of the dead and, like, falls in love with her, and it's... it's a very short film. It's got music in it. It's animated. It's by that same Danish animation studio that I've been watching a lot of shorts from, called The Animation Workshop. I think the animation is decent, but I think the story is trash. It's not very good. I think one review I read called it pervy, which I do tend to agree with, because the Queen of the Dead is animated very lasciviously in it, so
and naked.
Like, yeah, she's completely naked, and the story's just, you know, there's nothing there really. It's kind of garbagey, but yeah, I didn't like it. So take that.
You should definitely keep watching more of their films.
I'm definitely, like, I've got a pretty wide spectrum going at this point of likes and dislikes in terms of their films, because they vacillate pretty...
Not on this podcast.
Not on this podcast. I've only denounced them on this podcast, but I have a feeling that they may show up at the end of the year. They may come roaring back at the end of the year.
Your top 10 is just all their movies.
It is. It's just 10 animated shorts for the animation.
I am going to talk about a short also, but I'm going to herald it. It's a short film by Anna Lily Amarpour, who did The Bad Batch and A Girl Walks Home Alone at Night. When I went to see The Bad Batch, it played before that, and it's like a short film she made, I think, when she was still in college. It's from 2009. It's called Six and a Half. It's about a 6.5-year-old girl. It's really short, so I can't really talk about the story without giving it away, and there's something of a twist in it. But it felt really upsetting and interesting in a way I wasn't expecting. Like, when a short film started, I was like, like, because I didn't even know that it was directed by her until the very end of it, and I was like, oh, I don't know about this. But then the aesthetic was really cool. There's a lot of really neat shots, and I was like, oh yeah, don't really see this kind of like formal invention in like a short horror short usually. Short. I say the word short a lot. It's pretty fun. And also the child acting is pretty good, you know. I mean, it's not like astonishing, but for a movie made for almost no money starring a 6.5-year-old girl, she's pretty convincing. So,
is it about her being a film director and being like disillusioned with making art and
No, I think that that's just a jokey play. Like, it's more about representing what it's actually like to be 6.5 and how sometimes that's pretty awful.
Mm-hmm. Nice.
I believe it. Yep. And she, like, leads a band and a circus.
Yeah, I actually have both an announcement and a herald. And since Basil already mentioned it, I guess I could herald The Bad Batch, which I watched, which I liked. A movie that I liked.
Yeah.
Might have
been more people on my side.
More attentive person to our podcast probably heard Mitchell denouncing it on the mid-year podcast. And I definitely can see what could annoy someone about this movie.
Technically just the script. And I mean, how important is the script to a movie? Not like important at all.
It's not important to this movie, not to me.
Not really. I mean, there's a lot of stuff that goes on there that is like the same things that might have annoyed people or annoyed me about A Girl Walks Home Alone at Night could also plausibly annoy you about this movie. But for some reason, I felt like the cutesiness of A Girl Walks Home Alone at Night was kind of kept to a minimum here. And like, there was some really interesting kind of like this grossness in this movie that I really enjoyed. I like the acting a lot in this movie from like very unexpected sources, including a really weird Jim Carrey performance. Mm-hmm. Like also like a very strange Keanu Reeves performance and a pretty decent Jason Momoa performance. So all of that kind of came together pretty well for me. And Yeah.
I never even heard of Sookie Waterhouse.
Yeah, she was awesome great. Too. She was great.
I am liking the sound of this movie more.
I mean, I guess there could be some issue had also with this movie in terms of once again having like a able-bodied person perform like a disabled character, which you know, was the same problem with Mad Max Fury Road or whatever. Like, a lot of people gave that movie a lot of credit for that, but you know, would have been even more awesome if it was actual representation, but it's okay. Like, I don't think this movie really aims to, like, kind of piggyback off of, like, the plight of crippled people to make its point about anything.
It's not my left foot.
Yeah. And, I don't know, like, altogether, the movie was pretty surprisingly good to me, I enjoyed it. A lot more than I thought. So, thumbs up for that.
Cool.
Well, speaking, I guess, of going in different directions, I'm going to go in a different direction from Patrick and Basil. I'm going to talk about a movie that's very long called Once Upon a Time in Anatolia. Wow.
Nice.
That I did not like.
Oh, no, sad.
A little surprising, because I like his other two films that I've seen, Uzak and Winter Sleep. Neri Bilge, Ceylon, however you say that. So the first most, like, the first pretty much 2 hours of this movie is mostly just like a car ride where these criminals are trying to find someone that they killed, they're in possession of, the cops, and it's like just like a lot of either, you know, really silly discussions about like pasteurizing cheese or very serious discussions about like the nature of death. And it reminded me really strongly of A Taste of Cherry, but how I imagine Roger Ebert reacted to A Taste of Cherry, which was, this is boring. And a lot of like more really obviously pretty shots than that movie, but I didn't think it was nearly as pretty as A Taste of Cherry. And then after they find the body and they go back to town, the movie started to get interesting, and there was some more interesting stuff going on. Like, there's this one conversation between like the two sort of major characters, which is the doctor who does the autopsy and the prosecutor, and they're talking about a woman who maybe committed suicide and why she might have done that. And I was like, I wish more of the movie had stuff like this in it, and it made me dislike the beginning even more. But yeah, that is a big disappointment, especially considering how much I like Winter Sleep and how most people say that this is his best movie. No. I disagree.
I guess the only person who can do a Once Upon a Time in movie is Sergio Leone.
Yeah.
Then, they're still using that, which is big bummer. I found out there's a new movie with Bruce Willis the other day called Once Upon a Time in Venice that looks real terrible.
Is that Venice the Italian city or Venice Beach?
Venice Beach, baby. It's like a weird like Bruce Willis saw John Wick and was like, I want to be in a movie like that. So it's like him trying to get his dog back or something like that.
He's already in Die Hard. That's the same
thing.
Die
Hard's not like John Wick.
It's, I would say it's definitely an influencer of John Wick.
Sure, but Die Hard is like 100% committed to the idea of you associating with John McClane and like thinking that he's like a cool dude and like sympathizing with him, and John Wick is 100% the opposite.
Well, yeah, but
constantly at every turn undercuts your sympathy.
Yeah,
for
but
him.
I don't think that doesn't make the plot dissimilar. Like, it's still like one dude versus like 100 bad guys or whatever. You know, like.
Okay, well, that's most action movies then.
Well, yeah, but to your point, saying that like, he saw John Wick and was like, I want to do that. Like, I doubt his want to do it was like, I want to do a movie where I'm the monster. Like, I'm, you know, Michael Myers or whatever. I bet he saw it and he was like, I'm going to do a movie where I'm an old guy who could just, like, shoot a bunch of people. That seems more realistic to me from what I know of Bruce Willis. You know, because
it sounds
I know,
like Taken.
I know so much about, yeah. It does sound a lot like Taken too, also, doesn't it? That's the trend now. It's the old dude still got it. Old dudes can still shoot people.
Yeah. That's
I'm surprised I didn't even mention Taken when we were talking about Logan too. So it's kind of the same thing too, where it's like, oh yeah, the old guy can still do it. He's gotta protect his daughter or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Or his clone daughter, whatever she is.
It's true. But she does plenty of protecting herself in that movie. It's pretty fun.
It's true. It does subvert that element of the Taken series. Did we lose Ilya?
Yeah, we lost Ilya. He mentioned he warned us beforehand that he might get disconnected because...
I was going to wait until it came to the part where we asked people what they thought of the movie, and then I was just going to be like, Ilya? Ilya? But I guess that joke is over. Yep.
But yeah, internet troubles, so... He told us to forge on without him, and we're going to do it, just for you, listeners.
It's Basil's pick, so...
Sure is.
Yeah.
You want to tell us about the movie?
Yeah, all right. So this is a documentary. It's about the Hollywood blacklist and sort of kind of reframing the cultural conversation about both what the blacklist writers and directors were doing before they were blacklisted, and also about, you know, sort of reframing the blacklist itself in a more equitable light, I would say, like in terms of how bad it was rather than, you know, I think that there's like kind of a bit of, you know, oh, that was too bad that that happened. But I think that this movie tries to kind of dig in and show lots of different angles and also show the shortcomings. Like, it could have just been, you know, the blacklist was one of the worst things that happened to Hollywood. Look at all these great people who had nothing but amazing things to say. And so, but it does also bring in some of the shortcomings that the writers were dealing with personally and professionally. So I guess I would normally go to Ilya, but he's not here. So Ruben, what do you think of this?
I liked it.
Well,
what about you,
thanks
Patrick?
Thanks for joining us on the podcast. I also like this movie. I feel like I generally just enjoy Tom Anderson's essay style of like going through stuff point by point and then finding a cinematic counterpoint. I will say though that I am I'm a little underwhelmed by the construction of this one. He clearly didn't have the same sort of budget that he had on Los Angeles Plays Itself, because this movie looks like it was put together in like a computer lab on a college campus, like in its entirety. It looks like somebody was just like, you know, in there like cut paste clips into Premiere or whatever, because a lot of the clips are, the formatting's not right on them, so some of them appear like little squares in the middle of the screen, and I was like, that's probably not intentional. That seems like a shortcoming of the the clip that they had that they imported into the timeline or whatever.
They were probably using Avid at that time.
Yeah, something like that. Avid or Final Cut or whatever. Yeah,
I guess Premiere didn't exist in 1995.
Okay, I thought Premiere was a little older, but I guess so. Yeah, probably was Avid. You're right. Or they may have.
I know Avid existed, and I know Vegas existed.
Yeah, or they may. Well, I guess they probably didn't splice it together. Doesn't seem like it's film. It feels like a video. Construction, but yeah, you're probably right, Avid. I think that it definitely like hits some hard points, and especially its take on crime movies, I found really invigorating. I was like, oh wow, that's a really cool like take that I don't know that I'd ever like heard put into those words before, where they say that all crime movies are about capitalism, because, you know, it's about, like, you know, needing money and having to get money fast. And, yeah, I thought that was pretty fascinating. So, yeah, raised some very good points.
Yeah, I'm basically in the same boat. I might be slightly more in the middle on it, but for the most part, Like, at first I thought I was really not going to like it because I didn't like the construction at all. And I think that the second interview is, like, being conducted outside and you can hear someone mowing the lawn in the background. And I was like, oh, this, it's obvious they made this for, like, almost no money. And they're just like, well, this is the interview we got. We got to use it. So here it is. But
that happens all the time in Los Angeles too, by the way. If you shoot anything outside, there's always somebody with a lawnmower or a like gas leaf blower or a weed eater or somebody just like doing something that is inordinately loud.
Got some inside baseball.
Yeah, very nearby. I'd say that as a sound guy, I'm always just like, stop trimming your trees. Like, why?
Yard maintenance is terrible. People should stop doing it.
Do
I believe that
all
both
sorts of reasons.
Yeah, for audio and for many other reasons. But yeah, so
a waste of water.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so like as far as the form goes, I think this is a lot less. Like. Well put together and cohesive then. Los Angeles Plays itself, or even the thoughts that once we had, but I did really like the information that it laid out, and I was like, this is kind of like watching a fun, like, 2-hour college lecture. Like, feels pretty good. And that the clips that they pull out are pretty awesome, actually. So...
I really want to watch the movie. I think it's called Tom, Dick, and Harry, where it's like the priest is marrying the woman, but he keeps saying like the truthful part of it, and then like she goes back to the house, and the actor who plays her husband is also playing her children, and they're like screaming in the house, and he's never there. He just always just comes in the door, and he's like, I just got promoted to the super assistant, deluxe assistant of the assistant assistant.
Yeah,
that movie looks
gotta make a million.
So bonkers.
Yeah, I got the door. Yeah,
I couldn't believe. I was like, I can't believe that this movie existed in the 40s. It's so weird. Like, just like this nightmare marriage, and then he's like, I just got promoted to president, and she's like, I know. No, President of the United States.
Yeah. It also made me want to watch Salt of the Earth, too.
That one looked good as well.
I saw a few of them that I actually had on the blacklist. Mm-hmm. Movies that I wanted to do. He Ran All the Way was in here, but that one did not look very good. So I was like, it looks all right, but not great.
But also the thing that I was going to, like, it went a lot deeper and further than I was expecting. That was the other reason why I didn't think that I would like it at the beginning, because I was like, oh, this is, like, kind of interesting, but I feel like I already know all this stuff, like, but then it really, really went for it. And I did, as I mentioned in my sort of plot description, I did like when the part when talked about how, like, the left wing was really pushing for this kind of isolationism, but that in their ways of pushing for it, it came across just as, like, racist and sexist as the right-wing isolationism.
Yeah, that clip from Woman of the Year was pretty telling.
Yeah.
It's Spencer Tracy just being racist to that guy who doesn't know how to speak English.
Yep.
What's that movie about?
Woman of the Year? Yeah, I don't know. It seemed confusing. I was like...
It seems like a... I don't know. It's like a rom-com, isn't it?
Yeah, I think so. But like a rom-com where yeah. Like her cosmopolitan stuff is like, never mind. It's better to just be like a good old Spencer Tracy. Let's get married.
Settle down and be an American housewife. Oh, boy.
Yeah, I thought that was interesting in the other part when the woman, like, starts to stand up for herself at first, but then when the guy leaves, she's like, oh, I'm so tired of being a businesswoman. Never mind. Let's But then they counter that with the Susan Hayward one, which is pretty awesome. I really want to watch that movie. That seems pretty great.
Yeah. I don't remember the name of the first one, but at that part I wrote down Blonde Venus because it reminded me of my feelings on that. She just keeps getting like forced into these situations that maybe she doesn't want to do.
Right.
That's the pretend she's happy with. And then the second movie, they dispense with all of that, and she just yells at a dude for 10 minutes.
Pretty great. And then he's like, oh, well, if you won't marry me, then I quit. And she's like, no, you won't. You can't quit. We got a contract. You're going to work for me, and you're going to like it.
I guess I didn't really notice the form stuff as much as y'all did. The reason why I didn't like this as much as Wes Anderson plays itself is I don't think that Tom Anderson's understanding of politics is as strong as his understanding of film. And I kept thinking, I wish this was co-directed with Adam Curtis.
Oh, man.
Because it would have a deeper pull of history.
Yeah.
I don't know. I didn't feel like I learned that much, but not because I knew all of this going in, but because I didn't feel like there was that much information conveyed for a 2-hour runtime.
Yeah. Well, I think
they... good podcast so far.
Yeah. You're making points that I'm not 100% sure how to respond to, and also breaking up slightly as you do them, so it makes it slightly difficult. But, I mean, I think I agree that it's not a ton of information. I think, I mean, at least partly because they do sort of, like, front-load the movie clips. Like, there's just, like, a lot, like, probably half or more of the movie's runtime is just different clips, and that there's often not narration over the clips, so it's just like, here's some cool clips from a bunch of different movies from this era. It made me want to watch a lot of them, so that part's cool. But yeah, the way in which like it ties into sort of, I don't know, I think picking out the more like interesting and subversive messages was pretty cool. Like, I've seen They Live by Night, and I never really connected that to, like, an item, like, the kind of, like, attack on traditional marriage stuff that that they point out with that scene. Like, that scene is pretty sad, but, like, I never sort of figured out just how, like, tied in the personal pathos was to the sort of more large thing going on that's like
it's like pushing back against marriage, like
critiquing
kind of critiquing marriage in a way,
the norms,
critiquing the American dream, as it were. Yeah, because I think that's part of the idea too, is that it's like the most ugly capitalist version of the American dream, where it's like, oh yeah, like getting married is part of that dream, like we can sell it to you for cheap because, you know, you don't have enough money within the system to, you know, do it, you know, do it big and do it, you know, luxuriously. It's like, but you still want this thing, right? You want this thing that everybody is striving for, to be married and to have a house and kids and whatnot.
Yeah, I did think that was fun to tie it into as like an intentional ideological project to just make women work less so that they wouldn't have to worry about unemployed soldiers. They're like, no, get married and don't have a job. Then we can get this like unemployed veteran and put him in your job instead.
Yeah.
It works out for everybody.
Yeah.
And so that they can buy things.
Yeah, that true.
Yeah, it's something that Henry Ford figured out. He's responsible for the 5-day work week for many reasons. And so you know, we can be thankful for that, but we also know from his, you know, correspondence and whatnot that the reason why he wanted people to work 5 days is so that they could have Saturday off, because they worked 5 days and then they went to church and he was like, they're not spending enough money. If we give them a day off, they'll be able to spend that hard-earned cash.
Good job. Yeah, and then I mean, the next project obviously was sort of pushing back against the day of rest, you know, that an increase in atheism has also been an increase in places being open on Sunday, and that's even more time to spend money.
Yeah. Yeah, it's... Oh my gosh, I had something to say and I just completely forgot what I was going to say. Yeah, it's interesting to me, like, how quickly, like, popular opinion sort of turned on a dime, mm-hmm. like, within the space of just a few years, where it was like, all right, it's 1941, we're all in on the war, like, we, you know, we hate the fascists, we want to, you know, crush Germany or whatever, and then, like, immediately after the war, everybody was like, Russia's the real threat, like... They were just on our side, and we were like, no, they're the real threat, guys. Get it together. I think the fascists weren't so bad. Like,
the movie does a really good job of pulling from that one clip where there's, like, that guy who's, you know, like, dying. He's, like, on his deathbed or something like that, and he's talking about how another war is coming, like, you know, the war where, like, people will overthrow everyone and communism will take over, and then the other guy's just like, I don't want another war. And that's like the way in which they sold it. It was just like, you know, it, because it's true that, you know, like within Marxism and Lenin or whatever, like that a violent revolution is like a necessary part of the success of communism. So like by tying the horrors of World War II to communism, of being like, we have to fight communism because otherwise there'll be another war, there'll be a World War III, and we don't want that, do we? And everyone's like, you're right, we don't. Smart gambit, pretty gross.
Yeah.
But
that's one of the things that's interesting to think about, is just the way stuff was sold back in the day. Like there were so different parameters for selling it too, because yeah, I guess you could like actively play on that fear of like, you don't want another war, do you? Like, whereas now it's like, you know, anyone in the U.S. saying like, we just started another war, it's like, it doesn't really have the same effect, because we're just like, oh, another war, like, no, we don't want another war, like, we're tired of wars. But, like, if another war is started, we're just like, well, I guess we're in another war, like, it doesn't have nearly the same effect of, like, we're gonna send everybody over there and you're all gonna have to, like, go run in front of machine guns and stuff like that.
Yeah. So, well,
yeah, yeah, that's for two reasons. One, most of the generation who was in the last war that was that devastating have passed on now, so they can't be like, no, that's a terrible idea. And then the U.S. has created a system over the last 40 years where they don't go to war, but they're also constantly at war, so we've just put it as part of a normal, like, part of our lives. We're just like, oh, are we bombing Liechtenstein now? That makes sense. We bomb places. That's what we constantly do. We're constantly bombing places.
Yeah.
You know, I just had this, like, brief discussion with someone the other day about it, about, like, you know, how the U.S. is, like, constantly at war, and they were more on the side of what the U.S. would say, which is that they're keeping the peace. And I was like, no, they're constantly at war.
It's, I was listening to a podcast recently where they talked about, like, the way of waging war in the post-World War II era was basically like sort of a shadow war, where it was like, we're supporting
this group of combatants, but we're not at war with this other country. So we're like, you know, we're feeding weapons to, you know, other fighters on the ground. We'll send troops over there as support, but we're not in a war, like, quote unquote war with this other country. And that was kind of like the way that the Korean War was fought, where it was like, we're not at war with China, like, we're going over to Korea to, like, handle this situation, but, you know, we're not at war with China. China's not at war with us, even though we're fighting, you know, Chinese forces, and we're fighting North Korean forces in Korea. We're not technically in a war. But yeah, that is also, like, it's gotten even more, I guess, like, diffused in the sense that, like, it's not concrete that we're at war, because now we just, instead of sending troops, we can just, like, send a robot to fly over and drop a bomb. And it's just like, you know, it, in the old days, like, if you flew a plane over somewhere and dropped a bomb, like, that was an act of war. You were at war with them. Now it's just like, oh, no, we're just, you know, fighting insurgents. Like, the term insurgents is such a, like, catch-all term now for just anyone that we deem is worthy of having, you know, a drone bomb dropped on their head.
So let's start a real war. Let's start the communist war that they were worried about. Let's do it. Sounds good to, like, me.
Get out in them streets.
I love to war.
But,
law.
What was I going to say?
When,
oh, go ahead.
I don't know if it was something about Hollywood or something about these types of films, but the section about crime, like, the same actor was in almost all of the films.
And oh, yeah, John Garfield.
Yeah.
But, yeah, they mentioned very briefly at the very end that he actually...
Like, no, not that guy.
Oh, not that
guy. A different guy.
Oh. Oh, yeah, I know the one you're talking about.
He's like
now.
A bigger guy with, like, kind of bulgy eyes. He's, like, there's a scene of, like, two people at a table where one is, I guess, selling out the other. He's not the guy in glasses.
Yeah. He's also in the, but, like, he seems less ideologically motivated because he's in the, like, the one that John Garfield's in that's, like, you know, sort of a pro-communist movie, but then he's also in the, like, So I Married a Communist or whatever that movie is called.
Yep. No, he's just in all of them. I don't know why.
Same with Robert Ryan, though.
He's just a, you know, he's just, like, a stock, like, character actor. You know, like, Lloyd Bridges is in one of them, too. Mm-hmm. I was like, oh, it's Lloyd Bridges.
Yeah. But Robert Ryan was in Asphalt Jungle, and then he was also in the... So I Married a Communist or whatever it's called.
Yep. And
also, he named names, I think.
Oh.
Yeah.
I'm surprised they didn't talk about Crossfire at all, but I guess it wasn't directly tied to the themes they were talking about. Although there was the whole thing about the house I live in, where they're talking about how, like, didactic the like anti racism.
Yeah, that was pretty funny.
Were.
Like the Frank Sinatra after school special.
Yeah. I assumed that they were going to talk about Crossfire at that point, because I was like, oh yeah, that big, like, speech that the police detective gives in Crossfire has got to be in here for that, right?
But I bet it was in the first draft, but maybe they cut it because the Frank Sinatra one makes the point well enough and it's funnier.
Yeah. And it's got a song.
Hey, kids. You are about to beat up this Jewish kid. Gather around while I sing to you your anti-Semitism away.
Oh, yeah, Ruben, I wanted
being
to ask you.
Being hateful isn't right. Don't do it. Thanks, Frank Sinatra.
Fly me to the moon.
As someone who is studying this specific thing, I thought that the part where they use psychoanalysis on the black guy to figure out why he...
Yeah,
that's one of the I mean, very dumbed down, of course, but that's one of the theories about why racism exists, is that white people are actually a minority on the earth, and once they realized this, when they started going to other nations, the insecurity about it caused them to foist their insecurities on other people, mm-hmm. which is kind of what the guy is talking about, although he's doing it in a very victim-blamey way. He's like, you shouldn't let them voice their insecurities on you. Yeah. You should feel better about yourself. Yeah. And it's like, well, no, he's not the problem.
You should pull yourself up by those emotional bootstraps.
Hey, children. Yeah. Hey, children, have you tried not being abused?
No.
God. Oh, man.
But yeah, I have studied that. It's an interesting theory. I think probably the more straightforward one is right, which is that as capitalism gained traction as an economic system, the necessity for an underclass to exploit became clear, and they were like, let's exploit these strangers. And, you know, the combination of a need to exploit with the, I guess, human instinct to other communities that you haven't interacted with very much is probably the root cause of most of racism.
Yep. Divide and conquer, basically. Gotta have something to drive a wedge between all the poor people.
Yeah.
That's the one thing that most uneducated people respond to is, hey, this person looks different than you.
Yeah, it's interesting. I had heard of Salt of the Earth. This is only somewhat tangentially connected, but in the fact that it stars, you know, mostly people of color, which is pretty cool, and but that the initial conception behind it was to like break the blacklist by essentially starting their own studio, but then the studios crushed the movie and refused to let distributors show it, so then their project failed right away.
It's too bad.
They didn't know it at the time, but they probably could have gotten away with out showing any more RKO pictures, because that studio was going to go in the fold.
Yeah. They could have been like, fuck the you, RKO. Ones,
they probably still needed
the rest of you.
Paramount and whatnot.
Okay, don't fuck the rest of you. The rest of you.
Still hanging around.
Real cool, but fuck RKO. Yeah,
so I just gone to the Weinstein brothers. They're probably like 3 years old at that point.
Oh, man. Yeah. That's right. We needed a Miramax. Yeah,
the other thing that's interesting about that is that, I mean, I guess, like, you know, I never put it together, but I just assumed because of the ways in which like leftist sentiment was pretty strong in the 30s, even within like some parts of Hollywood cinema or whatever, I thought it was interesting that they said that, you know, like striking was never shown as a good thing until Salt of the Earth in 1953, and even that wasn't made by a major studio, so like that even if you were about even if you were sympathetic to like the suffering of like working class people, the answer to that was never to go on strike.
Yeah, that scene was pretty great and so sad, where the guy like is, you know, trying to get the people to strike, and then the other guy just like pushes him into the river and starts giving his own speech. And his speech is like, "Remember when we were kids and we used to beat the crap out of each other?" And they're like, "Yeah!" Yeah. He's like, "But then remember how when someone else came into town, you know, we would all join together to beat the crap out of them?" And they're like, "Yeah!" And I was like, "Both sides of this story are terrifying."
Oh my god. Was that also Spencer Tracy? I can't.
It sure is.
I think so. This is all he did, apparently.
Just the voice of the voice of capitalism in every movie.
They're like, they didn't even like write him into roles. He would just walk into back lots and be like, "Hey, do you need anyone to be extremely right wing, guys?"
Like Striking is the movie that we watched for the podcast earlier. The Striking is like what ruins him, and he's real sad about it.
Mannequin.
Mannequin. Couldn't think of the name for some reason.
It has nothing to do with the movie.
Yeah, it has nothing to do with Striking. Yeah, it's just that one scene where Joan Crawford is a mannequin.
But yeah, I like that the characterization of him is and early on in the movie, plain spoken chauvinism.
Yep. Does anybody need an everyman to be the voice of unbridled capitalism around here?
Yeah, they're like talking about Katharine Hepburn, and it's like but she was no match for his plain spoken chauvinism. Yep. That's a good part. So this was a quote that we didn't put at the beginning of the movie, but I just wanted to mention briefly the part where the guy was like, there wasn't any plot to put social content in the movies. He was like, movies are a message, and message is lives, and lives is social content. I just wanted to, I mean, I'm sure anyone who's actually listening to our podcast is already on this train, but just another reminder to the people who want to be like, oh, it's all form, or it's all plot, or it's all whatever, like,
yeah,
everything is the political act.
Yeah, there's no such thing as
a non-political act.
Yep.
It's I think there's a Roger Ebert quote where he says that he doesn't look at movies based on like what they say, but like how they say them. And I've always been just like,
But
you can't ignore like the content of a movie just because, you know, it has good cinematography
and clever writing.
Yeah.
But he sure did, so. Or didn't when it suited his needs.
Yeah.
Because he definitely wasn't, you know.
He definitely deflected a lot.
He would critique movies' politics sometimes when he felt like it and ignore their politics other times when he liked the movie, so.
Yep.
Sometimes it worked out in its favor, though, like with David Lynch, someone who makes very boring cinematographically and edited movies, and people like them because they're weird in other ways. And he was like, no, this movie is boring. And I was like, you are correct, sir.
Yeah, him and Rosenbaum were basically the only two that were on that train. Both of them liked Eraserhead, but then were like, oh, Blue Velvet, this is like a way more boring version of that movie you already made. And then Rosenbaum took it further and was like, oh yeah, Twin Peaks is an even more boring version of the same thing you were already doing.
I like how boring Twin Peaks is, though.
Well, he meant in a different way, I think, than you mean.
Oh.
I think he probably meant like slow moving.
Yeah.
No, he
meant
boring.
I think he meant not interesting, but I like how like slow moving and like languid that show is. Because it's such
I don't totally dislike Twin Peaks, by the way. Oh, I haven't watched the new one at all, but the original one, I totally dislike it. Right?
Yeah, there's some cool stuff in it.
But yeah, no, his point was more that, like, he's taken his already, this idea, I guess, that he's now doing for, like, the third time, and he's TV-ified it, and people think that it's making TV better, but it's actually making movies worse.
Right.
That it's, like, this sort of water cooler movie that's about, like, discussing the latest episode, but not with any, like, sort of meaning or depth, which is... which was really cool to read, but also kind of sad, because that was mostly, like, my main argument about, like, the golden age of television as well. And I'm like, oh, Jonathan Rosenbaum made this argument 30 years before.
Yep.
I would get around to it. Well, not 30 years, 25 years.
He's a smart guy. He's on the precipice.
Yeah. But yeah, I mean, it's completely off subject, but I definitely feel like, especially with, like, Netflix having taken over shows and, like, the idea of, like, binging and whatnot, that it's moved even further away to, like, a consume, critique, react cycle, like, that has to be done within, like, a couple days. Like, just, I guess, to bring it back to movies a little bit, Miriam Bale has been, who is a black critic, has been upset about some of the claims of racism about Sofia Coppola's movie, The Beguiled, but because she didn't pitch her what she wanted to write about it within 5 days of it coming out, they're like, why would we publish that?
Right.
Well, because it's good, is why.
Yeah, it's, yeah, I think it's interesting. Yeah, I mean, especially Netflix's model, which the other ones seem to not be following, of just, like, dump it all in one day, that, you know, that even the sort of, like, anticipatory conversation that would happen with a weekly show that was kind of a hit has, like, disappeared or whatever, that you can't, like, have a thing where you're like, oh, yeah, and remember this part? Well, I wonder where that's leading, like, and sort of, like, even though those conversations can be superficial, they can, you know, also begin to delve into what the show is trying to deal with or is about, and that those are kind of denied to people now, at least via the Netflix model, because...
And even, like, not just that, but, like, just the way that their page is, like, structured, like, the fact that within, like, a week or two, that thing that they just dumped is going to be moved to the second page, you know, or whatever, so people, like, you know, like, it was great or whatever that 13th was released by Netflix, but how long did it spend at the top of their page? Like, 5 days?
Right.
10 days?
Yeah, and I'm also, like, I'm also convinced that Netflix's sort of philosophy for, like, acquiring and releasing things is just, like, don't worry too much about quality. Like, sometimes you'll put out something that's really shitty that somebody will just love for no reason. And it all just sort of goes on there. Anyway, because I've watched a lot of stuff on there, and I'm just like, this is really terrible, but I bet somewhere somebody likes this. And I bet, you know, like, it seems like they just sort of ignored the idea of, like, taste or whatever, because they're just like, well, just put it on there. Like, you know, maybe somebody will watch it and it'll catch on. Or, you know, like, people often, like, spend hours just, like, flipping through, and, like, sometimes we'll put a new poster on, like, an old thing that's been on here forever, and then it'll get a bunch of views, and it's just like, you know, it's kind of a weird approach to doing stuff. It's not, like, actually curating the stuff they release. It's just like throwing everything at the wall and, like, seeing what sticks a lot of the times.
Yeah. I mean, some of that, you know, some of that I agree with and some of that I disagree with, because, like, something that I sort of lament about the modern Hollywood model is the destruction of the B-movie, I guess, which is oftentimes, like, something that is, we find out later that we ended up really liking or becomes, like, part of the critical canon, is the, like, 45-minute to, like, 80-minute movie that preceded the feature. You know, these cheap movies that they were just like, oh, we have to make something. And so there was a lot more experimentation and variability there. And I think that is also missed. I, like, think that's an important part that's missing with Netflix. But, like, the idea of them willing to try different things to, like, find different audiences rather than, like, having, like, a specific, like, focused vision, like, where... I mean, sometimes that can work, but, like, the worst example would be, like, the Marvel Cinematic Universe, where everything has become so streamlined and the same that, like, why would you... I mean, obviously people do, but, like, you know, it's like a fast food experience of a movie. It's like, I know I'm going to get the same thing, and this is the meal that I want. And I'm like, man, I just can't imagine.
Yeah.
Like, just I barely want that when it comes to food. I really don't want it when it comes to creative entertainment.
Yeah, there's no way, for me at least, if a McDonald's hamburger costs the same as a good burger, I'd never eat a McDonald's hamburger. It's only the amount of money that I save that keeps me coming back. Yeah. So maybe I'd enjoy Marvel movies more if they were shorter. Yeah. If they were like half an hour, I'd be like, well, that wasn't that good, but it didn't cost me much in terms of being a lifetime.
Yeah, that's sort of what I was thinking about, was that like these movies have gotten longer. So instead of having like an hour and 45 minute feature and then like a 40 minute, short or whatever B movie that precedes it, like Detour or something like that, they're just making 2.5 hour movies. And I'm like, chop off 30 minutes of that movie, show me another hour movie that like only cost like $150,000 that you just let some person like try to, because it's still make money because it's tagged to the Marvel movie.
That would be fun to just like, I don't know. Yeah,
instead of making everything a tentpole.
Yeah, I love a nice tight like short movie. Like, give me The Shallows. Give me more of that.
Give it to me.
I think that's something that everyone on this podcast, even those of us who sadly were cut off by our bad internet, agree on. It's nothing quite like a tight movie.
Too bad about 47 meters down, because that was literally them trying to give us The Shallows again, but it didn't work.
Yeah. Maybe don't give us the same movie again so soon.
So many problems with that movie. First of all, like, how few shark attacks there are. That's true. There's so little shark stuff going on. 47 down. It's advertised as a shark movie, and it's mostly people dealing with the problems of being down at a very low depth.
Yeah. I'm sure that some of that's budgetary, because I think that the movie was initially supposed to be direct-to-video, but then after The Shallows did so well, they decided to release it as a...
I like how that's something that I posited and now is becoming fact by us just repeating it.
No, I've read it other places.
Oh, okay.
They just splice in like stock footage of a shark. they're like look off screen, they're like, oh no, it's a shark. It's just this stock footage.
They splice in footage of Jaws, like of the movie Jaws.
Oh no, there's a shark.
Just
like they weren't able to cut the audio out, so there's just like a brief sting of like the dun dun dun.
Like they kill that shark, and they're like, "Oh no, it's another shark!" And it's the same footage, but the shark has a little mustache on it.
Let me look over my notes here.
Oh man,
yeah. I liked all the stuff about the how corrupt and awful college sports are, and how
that was really good
even back then.
Yeah, another one of those examples is something we talk about a lot on this podcast. We're like, man, that was prescient, and by prescient I mean none of the horrible systems that create these problems have changed.
Yep,
still there.
Yeah, it's a really cruel speech that he gives that guy too. He's like, you're gonna play, because what else, you're not big enough yet, in a week everyone will forget you. And then it'll just be another poor slob who used to play football.
Yeah, no, I mean, I don't know how that movie ends, but maybe the only difference between like that and now is like in Friday Night Lights, when the coach gives the speech, then the players are like, no!
Yeah.
But that's not what happens in real life. It's just a fantasy that we're force-fed.
Right.
Yeah.
They're just like, all right, I guess I'm playing.
You sit in the movie theater and we're like, yeah, way to stand up to the system that takes advantage of you. And then we tune in on Saturday and Sunday and we're like, walk it off!
Yeah.
Rub some dirt in it, you asshole!
Why are you retiring?
Yeah, that was always the thing that made me angry of the many, many things that made me angry about Any Given Sunday is that it, in one of the subplots, it broaches the idea of, like, how dangerous football is and, like, concussions and stuff like that, and, like, how
people's eyes getting knocked down.
Yeah. And, but then, and then there's, like, a defensive player who needs to, like, his bonus is tied to how many, like, sacks he gets or something like that, and they're all like, you better stop playing, and he's like, but if I get one more sack, then I'll have enough money that I can retire, and then they're like, yeah, but you might die, and then in the big game, he, like, gets his final sack, and then it does the thing where he just lays on the field for a really long time, and the audience is like, oh no, is he dead? And then he opens his eyes, and everyone's like, yeah!
That's the Jerry Maguire.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh boy.
That's why there wasn't a sequel to that movie. Because right. The next season he had to retire due to concussions.
Yep.
Oh no.
He got to retire though, because he got that extra sack. Yeah.
But then he started losing his mind 2 years later. Yep.
Hey, it's more like 15 years later.
Yeah. He couldn't remember things. And it
takes a while for those brain problems to show up.
Drove his car into the front of a CVS. Yeah, there's a lot of, like, really sad things that are completely avoided at, like, the Pro Football Hall of Fame. Like, I went there a few years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And I made a video of just all of the heads that were depicted in the building. So I just, like, filmed, like, heads that were in pictures. And then, like, they have, like, the busts of the players, too. So I just filmed the busts of the players. And I just edited it to, like, the, like, rousing, like, football music. And then, like, the last shot is me, like, panning down the line of people who were being inducted that year. And then the last one is, like, Junior Seau, who, you know, like, killed himself because he had brain trauma. So, I don't know. It wasn't a subtle movie, but...
Who needs subtlety?
I don't know.
For the birds.
Yeah.
Subtlety can be dumb, too.
Yeah.
True.
It's what the movie demands. No... constant answer, otherwise everyone could make successful movies.
Yeah, I mean, Paul Verhoeven should do without subtlety for the most part.
I've seen something like this a lot of times, but I laughed / was very sad at the part when the guy said, like, when they were talking about committing suicide or something like that, and he was like, you need money to buy a gun.
Oh yeah, yeah. That's pretty dark too. Man.
Like that part I mentioned in The Survivalist when they've got, like, we've got three bullets, enough for the three of us. Mm-hmm. Always works.
Dark. Dark. Jesus. You can't even kill yourself under capitalism. So you gotta go.
That's about it for me. Notes wise.
The other thing that
Tom, Dick, and Harry that I wanted to see, the only one that I really wanted to see were all the communist movies, Song of Peasants, and the ones Communist Kitsch, all that stuff looked good to me.
Yeah, the ones where they're singing that big musical about working together, that looked pretty fun.
And plowing the fields.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah, that was the other part I wanted to talk about when, you know, like after Ayn Rand came out and was like, no, communism's awful. And everyone's like, everybody knows Russians don't smile. You got it wrong. But, yeah, I don't know. It seems, like, it's funny, especially his rebuttal to that was like, oh, yeah, I guess it was propaganda. It was also propaganda about America being great. Like,
yeah.
That was what we were doing. It was the war.
Pro-American
we're just
propaganda.
Making propaganda.
It's about how much Russian people love America.
Yep.
because we were all at war together. Yeah, that's that's again, like, it's sort of those crazy things where it's like the perceptions, like, flipped so fast because they were like, we're all in this together, and they were like, they're the enemy, like, immediately. It's like, but
yeah, just, I mean, you know,
we were just making movies about how we were good friends.
You see that in real life. Malcolm Gladwell, who, someone I become less and less interested with each passing day, though, you know, wrote a book about it called Tipping Point, and I think he's probably right, which is the idea that there's, like, I guess, people on the front lines of cultural change who start to pick something up, and then at a certain point it reaches a critical mass, and then suddenly it's like floods the marketplace. I mean, think about, you know, for instance, gay marriage. Like, did we, like, when I was in college and, like, the first thing happened, I was like, yeah, but that's, it's not going to be. It's going to be forever before that happens.
Right.
And suddenly it happened.
Yeah. I mean, and the other sort of, like, well, I mean, ideological thing that we can historically point to, obviously, is, like, you know, the Middle East or whatever, and that our allegiances are shifting constantly there, and, you know, how good or not good we want people to look on a given day, we're able to, is pretty easily manipulated, and so, like, Saddam Hussein, pretty cool guy. Saddam Hussein, worst guy ever.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, just Muslims in general, pre-9/11, were often considered, like, the model minority by the right because they were cared about family values, they were religious, they were hardworking.
Controlled a lot of oil.
That was, yeah. Well, I mean, American Muslims, they weren't carrying around bags of oil with them.
Yeah, I feel like that... Like, from what I remember, my memory of this is a little hazy, but I seem to remember, like, the like, sheik who controls a lot of oil was, like, a stock character in, like, I don't know, like, just bad TV shows or whatever, where it's, like, somebody would show up as, like, a deus ex machina and be like, I want to buy this bar or whatever, you know, like, or they're trying to, like, save a rec center or something and, like, right. I want to buy this rec center or whatever, like... Not also, like, similar to the, like, Texan who owns a lot of oil. Like, it was just, like, another, like, stock character where it's like, oh, yeah, this is, I can see why right-wingers are into this.
Yeah, I mean, that's the basic history, obviously, of, like, animosity towards Iran or whatever, that there was a sheik that was in charge, and we liked that guy because he really helped us out, and then... Everyone in Iran was like, this guy's a garbage, corrupt person. I hate him. Get him out of here. Now we're like, fuck you, Iran. You took away our guy.
Wait a second. Yeah.
I mean, obviously, it's a lot more complicated than that, but...
It always is. Yeah. But Malcolm Gladwell's... Next book wasn't as well received. It was just a biography of the Star of the Birds called The Tippy Point.
Good one.
That's not nearly as socially aware, that book.
Yeah, well, that's my problem with him, is that he doesn't really care about, like, social issues, really. That he's a social scientist who doesn't, like, think about those things. Like, he had this tweet that is so embarrassing, where it was, like, the day that Trump was elected or something like that, where he said something like, I didn't really believe that racism was still happening until today, and people were like, what?
Yeah. What, like... Jesus fucking Christ. He was just asleep while Ferguson was happening, like...
I don't know.
just taking a snooze while they burn down the CVS in Baltimore, just like...
I mean, even before that, what about when they were lynching, what's the word for when you build, like, a dummy of someone?
Yeah, when they were burning effigies.
Lynching and burning effigies of Obama.
Just a couple of bad eggs.
Yeah.
It's not a systemic thing.
Some bad apples. So, just... Oh, boy.
Anyway.
Yeah.
So, we ready to wrap this one up?
Let's do it.
All right, everyone. Thank you for listening to our podcast. I hope you are enjoying it and that you will subscribe using your podcast listing application and you will not blacklist us.
Yeah.
Or do. It may make us more popular than we are now for your blacklisting. Go ahead, blacklist us. See what we care.
You can also always give us a 5-star rating review on iTunes and find all of our content on loosecannons.net. That's LOOSECANONS.NET. We've got writings, podcasts, and videos there. And if you want to join us in any discussion about this podcast or anything else film related, you can go to our boards. Which you can access through the website, or the address is what? loosecannons.boards.something?
It's loosecannonspodcast.boards.net.
There it is. If you have any questions or comments, you can email them to us at loosecannonspodcast@gmail.com, and if they are not cruel, we will answer them. Thanks for listening, everybody.
Woo!
Bye.
Happy Independence Day. Yes.
I think we nailed it.
Yep.
Happy Fireworks Day! Go throw some fireworks at people.